Welcome to episode number 12 of Tech Talk Today on WCCR 94.5 LPFM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. As always, we enjoy tweets to @WCCRTechTalk during the show with your comments and ideas. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's Tech Roundup. Well, how many times have you reached down to plug in something in the USB and you've got it turned around the wrong way, and you flip it around, and it still won't plug in, and you flip it around again, and then you get it? Well, finally...
Once or twice.
For me, that happens quite often, when at least I'm not looking at it. So, a reversible USB Type-C connector has been finalized. Devices, cables, and adapters coming soon. This is pretty long. USB Promoter Group has announced the greatest invention for the known universe. I don't know about that. The reversible Type-C USB connector. It's finally ready for mass production. I'm just going to skip a bunch of this. Basically, it's it looks, if you just glanced at it, it looks very similar to the USB micro USB, which is the smallest iteration of USB that I know of. And just to go through, type A is the one that plugs into your computer. That one's the one that is rectangular. Then there's type B is the one that plugs into typically like a printer, typically larger devices. And then you've got mini USB. Trying to think of what mini USB looks like.
Looks like a mini version of the USB.
It's trapezoidal, I guess, more. And then the micro is really small, and type C is going to look very similar to the mini, except it's reversible. So that's pretty much it. This is going to be interesting because the type C spec has been finalized. It now comes down to actually implement this into sockets, plugs, cables, adapters, and devices. The problem is there are billions of existing USB devices and cables that would need adapters and new cables to work with the new Type-C devices. It's a lot like when Apple released the Lightning connector, but on an even grander scale, because, you know, there are definitely a lot of iPhones and, you know, devices Apple has, but there are more devices that have USB on it. So
I'd say we're probably going to see a gradual introduction of the Type-C connector onto computers and devices, you know, kind of like back in the day when we saw a gradual introduction of the USB port itself onto computers and devices.
I don't remember that.
I do. I remember very plainly having machines that did not have USB ports on them and only had serial connectors, you know, parallel ports and things like that, DB25s and DB9s. And then, you know, we came to USB and it was, you know, not very fast. And then you go to USB 2 and now we're at USB 3. And keep in mind that this Type C doesn't have anything to do with the speed.
Right.
It's just the orientation of the connector.
Right.
So, you know, it's going to be used on USB 3.0, which is the latest iteration and the highest speed. But I think you put it right. I mean, it's going to be very similar to the Lightning connector on your phone. You can orient the connector either way that you want to, which I agree with you, Kurt. You know, I was just joking earlier. I mean, there are multiple occasions where you plug the thing in the wrong way. I mean, if it's a device, you know, if it's like my flash drive that I use every day, I know which way to turn it.
Right.
If it's my flash drive on my computer, I know which way to turn it. But if it's my flash drive on somebody else's computer or somebody else's computer or my computer with somebody else's flash drive, you know, it's hard to tell how to use it. So I'm kind of concerned, though, about the size. You know, you pull your flash drive. I don't know if they're going to introduce this with flash drives. I assume they will. But you pull your flash drive in and out, in and out, in and out, you know, a lot. And I'm concerned that, which, I mean, I guess it's the same thing with the Lightning connector, too. You do it on your phone a lot. But I just hope they have created it
robust,
to be resilient, not to, you know, break off or whatever like that. Because you break one of those off in your USB port and you're hurting.
Right. I mean, that... You have to have a lot of hardware skill to repair that. That's something I would just, you know, unless it was really, really important, I'm not even going to look into it. I'd just say it's lost. Like you'd mentioned when I first mentioned this like a week ago, you said, well, you know, Apple did this quite a while back. They're just now playing catch up. So that's a good call.
I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a good thing.
Oh, interesting bit of trivia. USB, everyone, stands for Universal Serial Bus. Thank you.
Oh, I was just talking about cereal a while ago, wasn't I?
I love cereal.
Essentially, it was the next generation of serial ports. Is what it was. So
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. So it was, you know, you had serial ports on computers, and this was just the next generation of serial ports. It was just a better way to transfer data across. Engadget article, this is about sports tech. Wearables have become popular among athletes for monitoring the training progress, but it's also a recent Rise campaign stop in Shanghai. Nike took a different approach. Inside the so-called House of Mamba, NBA star Kobe Bryant hosted 30 young players, basketball players, from all over China who trained on a full-size LED basketball court, complete with projected graphics and motion tracking. The playing surface displayed reactive visuals on players' movements for drills based on Bryant's own regimen of drills and skills that he uses in his practice. A dozen athletes will compete this weekend in Beijing, with three winners moving on to the Nike World Basketball Festival in Barcelona next month. I watched a video of this. It was an Engadget article, and they had a video out there, a couple of videos of the court. And it's actually really cool. They showed them putting it down, and it's just a whole bunch of LED tiles. And they put those tiles down on the court, and they're resilient to, you know, you can jump on them, play basketball on them, everything like that. And they can obviously do whatever they want to with the court. So they put these bands on the arms of the players on each arm. And as the player moves around the court, they have cameras positioned around the top side of the court. And they track them with computers.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like the principle of a holodeck, except it's on a court. And it's really cool. They track them on the court, and then the computer is able to, you know, see where they're at on the court as they move, and they do drills, and the court actually shows them where to move for the drills. That's
pretty cool.
It was pretty slick video. It was pretty neat. I would like to seen that in person.
That'd be pretty cool. I never thought disco and basketball would mix so well.
And you know what they're talking about is using it as a training implementation. So you know, for young people and even older people, but young people especially, to learn how to play the game and how to move the right way around the court. And it was actually, you know, in basketball, when I used to practice for basketball, you know, you have drills where, you know, you go to certain parts of the court, you play around the world, you know, and you go to certain parts of the court to shoot for shooting drills and stuff like that. And so it was pretty neat. It was pretty neat that they had this type of stuff on the court so that they could train while they could train by watching the court. I thought it was pretty neat, pretty interesting. Interesting article.
Oh yeah, it's I'd love to see that. That'd be really exciting.
There's a video, you can go watch it.
I might have to. Let's see here. We've all heard about, you know, Internet Explorer. I hear a lot of animosity towards Internet Explorer being a very bad browser, and for a very long time it definitely was, and it can't really grow out of it. So Microsoft, for a while, considered renaming Internet Explorer to escape that reputation. Microsoft's Internet Explorer engineering team told a Reddit gathering on discussions about a name change that have taken place. It could happen again. From the article, Microsoft has had passionate discussions about renaming Internet Explorer to distance the browser from its tarnished image, according to answers from members of the developer team given in a Reddit Ask Me Anything, also known as an AMA, session today. In spite of significant investment in the browser, with the result that Internet Explorer is really quite good, many still regard the browser with contempt, soured on it by the lengthy period of neglect that came after the release of the once dominant version of 6. Microsoft has been working to court developers and get them to give the browser a second look, but the company still faces an uphill challenge. I don't know. About the only good thing I hear from IE lately is that it doesn't kill your battery.
I've heard they're going to change the name of it to Crash and Burn 12. That's what I'd heard. So
Cab.
Yeah, Crash and Burn 12. Cab. That's what we should submit that. That's what they should call it.
I don't know.
Open Cab. And go to.
Honestly, I don't have problems with IE. I mean, the only problem I have is whenever a developer doesn't want to bother testing in IE, which I can understand. You know, you want to get it to work in something. But there are four major browsers out there now. And that's why I hate web design. I'm so glad I'm not in that field of, you know, web design, but man, there's so many things, you know, so many different browsers you have to test on, and there's, you have to make things work with JavaScript, and then you have to make sure if there's any database calls just to load your web page, but then you have to make sure that you have, like, what Ajax, if you have any kind of a web stuff. Oh my goodness, I just can't.
Well, they're, you know, obviously Microsoft is barking up the correct tree here, because they're going to have to
rebrand it.
It is just, it's gone on for so long and gotten pounded so hard. And why does it get pounded so hard? Because it's the most used browser, because it gets installed on every Windows PC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not the case for any other browser out there. It's the only browser that gets installed on a PC or on a
it's
machine when it comes.
Default.
Well, Safari's like that too, but Mac's share versus PC share isn't even close.
10%.
So, you know, that's why it gets hit so hard. I mean, why do hackers try to...
it's fun to hit on... Yeah.
Exactly. Why do they try to crack IE? Because there's so much of it.
Biggest target.
Yeah, so...
I just can't.
I don't know what they're going to rename it, but I wouldn't blame them for doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Engadget article again about the Tesla, and in case you don't know, we've talked about the Tesla here on the show before. I think actually, Kurt, the week you were in Vacation Bible School, and our guest of the week then, Daniel Brooks, him and I talked about the Tesla cars. Obviously, Tesla's owner, Elon Musk, they create electric cars. And Edmunds, which is a group that tests different kinds of products, they posted their findings after blazing the highways in Tesla's Model S for nearly a year and a half. In addition to falling short of the promised 265-mile range, a series of service trips saw the drive unit replaced three separate times. CEO Elon Musk announced via the company blog that the warranty on that part, the drive unit, is being extended to match the battery pack's infinite mile coverage. The unit will be replaced within 8 years, no matter the odometer reading. What's more is that the new warranty terms apply to any Model S built thus far, not just the popular 85 kilowatt hour model cited in the report. He quoted, "If we truly believe that electric motors are fundamentally more reliable than gasoline engines, then our warranty policy should reflect that." So essentially what happened here, this group, they went out and they drove this car for a year and a half, and they had to replace the drive unit three times, along with a bunch of other stuff too. It was an interesting article out there where they went through and they drove this thing and had all these different problems with it. And it's a new design, you know, and it's going to have bugs and it's going to have problems, and it's built on stuff that's new. It's not like,
right,
you know, the gasoline engine that we've been using for, what, 100 years now?
Tried and true, tested, yeah.
Yeah, so, but it's, I'm glad to see a company come out and say, hey, we want this to work right, so we're going to warranty it all the way.
That makes
and
sense.
And not only that, but no matter what, we're going to replace it after 8 years.
That's cool. I like to hear that.
So, pretty excited about the future for electric cars. I would love to drive one of these just for the fun of it, but I don't have that much money.
Me either. Facebook tests a satire tag to avoid confusion on newsfeed.
Hashtag satire.
I think this is hilarious. An anonymous reader writes, in an attempt to keep you from having to explain to your crazy relatives that despite what they read, Vice President Biden didn't get a grow light delivered to the White House under a fake name, Facebook is testing a satire tag on newsfeeds. A Facebook representative issued the following statement to Ars Technica. We're running a small test which shows the text satire, and that's in square brackets, in front of links to satirical web articles and the related articles unit in newsfeed. This is because we received feedback from people who wanted a clear way to distinguish satirical articles from others in these units. I'm guessing they just got so many people that were, you know, seeing things from, say, The Onion, and they just knew that, you know, this was... They just kept getting calls on this, and they thought, well, we have to do something about this. Of course, now, I was reading some comments, it says, once they do this, it will eliminate this. It'll be useless, because then every time a politician will open their mouth, and they'll tag a headline as satirical, and, you know, then Facebook will say that's misrepresenting what they said. I mean, this is... I don't know. People just need to learn to discern articles. And they say that our generation, Generation Y, millennials, are the best at sifting through information and determining these. So this is quite obviously for previous generations, you know.
How do you tell... I've lost something here. How would Facebook tell when an article is satirical?
And that was another thing. Who gets to decide this?
Yeah.
Is automatically every single thing from The Onion going to be a satire? I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, this is I mainly laughed at this more than anything else, but satire. Now I remember somebody jokingly told the WW3, the World Wide Web Consortium, whatever they are, when they were developing HTML5 to include a sarcasm tag. So they tweeted back, that sounds like a great idea, /S/S.
/S, yeah. So, just kidding.
Yeah.
PC Mag article about Internet Explorer. Have you been having some trouble with your web browser, specifically Internet Explorer? If you notice that your Microsoft browser has felt as if it's been crawling to a halt lately, then we have some good news for you. Microsoft knows about the issue and has recently issued a hotfix to correct it. If you have no idea what we're talking about, then let's start from the top here. There are two Internet Explorer updates that, when applied to any iteration of the browser between IE 7 and 11... So we're talking to, yeah, a bunch of...
It's like every everything that should be out right now.
Exactly. Plus some. Could eventually cause the browser to grind to a halt. It was caused by web applications that implement consecutive modal dialogue boxes, according to the hotfix. So if the most important thing to gain from this article is, if you're using a PC with Internet Explorer, make sure that you have all the latest updates on your machine. So if you're using Windows XP, I'm sorry, you shouldn't be using Windows XP, because you've heard us say before that that's not under support anymore. But if you're using Windows 8 or Windows 7, especially Windows 7, make sure that you have the latest Windows updates, because this could actually cause some performance issues with Internet Explorer on your machine. That's a question that comes around in tech support a lot is, you know, why is my computer acting this way? And then you go and look and, you know, you say, okay, when's the last time you ran updates on this machine? It doesn't look like you have automatic updates turned on. And, you know, there's no updates for the last forever. So updates are important. And if you have a Microsoft Windows 7 machine or Windows 8 machine, make sure you've got automatic updates turned on.
Yes.
Or if you don't, make sure that you're updating it often.
You know, not even just Windows. I would say everything. You need to have automatic updates on pretty much everything. Because there's a reason things receive updates. They make them run better. They mainly, the biggest thing lately is security updates. So, I mean...
Yeah, if it's a security update, you want to try to update as soon as possible. Now, you know, firmware or OS updates, kind of like when iOS 7 right now. iOS 8 comes out, yeah, in the fall. That's probably something that you don't want to upgrade to on, like, day one. Because there's a possibility that when it gets out in the wild, meaning when it gets out to lots of people's phones, that they're going to run into a problem that they didn't foresee on all the beta testers. So you may want to give that one a few days. So big upgrades like that, give them a few days. But if it's a security update of some sort or a security patch, if you hear us raving on like we're going to here in a little bit about security issues, then, you know, make sure to check on those issues and get them patched.
Mm-hmm. The EFF, Electronic Front, the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, has a cell phone guide for U.S. protesters. They've updated its guide for protecting yourself and your cell phone at a protest. I didn't know there was such a guide, but okay. In addition to being extremely powerful tools, real-time communication to many watchers via social networks, cell phones can also give authorities a lot of information about you if they confiscate it. The EFF is trying to encourage cell phone use and prepare people to use them. The guide is based on U.S. laws, but much of the advice makes sense for other places as well, globally. Here are a few small snippets. Start using encrypted communications channels. Text messages, as a rule, can be read and stored by your phone company or by surveillance equipment in the area. If the police ask to see your phone, tell them that you do not consent to the search of your device. Again, since the Supreme Court's decision in Riley... There is little question that officers need a warrant to access the contents of your phone, for an arrest, but they may be able to seize the phone and get a warrant later. If your phone or electronic device was seized, it is not promptly returned when you're released, you can file a motion with the court to have the property returned. So, you know, nowadays people always talk about, did you get a video of that? Hey, did you see that? Did you see the pictures of this? You know, people pretty much always have a cell phone on them, and anytime they see something, they'll pull it out and record. So these are things that people need to consider before you just pull your phone out and start recording.
I'll remember this next time I'm at a protest.
You know. Yeah, fill out all my protest forms.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know me very well, that's very unusual. Well, actually, that's never been the case for me. I don't think I've ever been to... I know I've never been to a protest.
You seem like the type to give funding to a large blimp to fly over top of the...
Yeah, we talked about that several weeks ago, didn't we? Large blimp to fly over the NSA.
Yeah.
And everybody's trying to figure out why the NSA is advertising for themselves.
Illegal spying here.
Mm-hmm. Your turn.
My turn. Network World article, intrusion protection systems for your home at DEF CON 22, which is a security conference held in Las Vegas last week. San Jose-based IDIS Networks unveiled an intrusion prevention system that claims it can protect an increasing number of network-connected consumer devices from outside attacks. Attacks. I'll see if I can get that word out. The firm's iGuardian product, which the company hopes will be mass-produced starting in February of 2015, is a small device that can be installed in the front of a router to analyze incoming and outgoing network traffic for signs of malicious activity. Hmm. Network-based intrusion prevention systems, or IPSs, are security appliances typically used on business networks. Depending on the brand, specifications, and amount of traffic they can inspect in real time, their prices vary from a few $100s to thousands of dollars, making most of them too expensive for home use. With an estimated price for the iGuardian of $179, that's $179 US, IDIS Networks founders Jock Breitweiser and Daniel Ayoub, who previously worked at Dell SonicWall, which is a firewall, hope that their product will change that without sacrificing technical capabilities. The iGuardian runs on popular open source IPS software package called Snort, which is on top of OpenWRT, which is a commonly built Linux distribution for embedded systems. Snort is essentially a network program that looks at all network traffic that's going across the network and can analyze that traffic for attacks. The device will not only be able to block attacks from the internet, but also malicious traffic originating from inside the network. So, for example, if malware running on a local computer tries to contact a known bad server, the device could block that communication using IP address or URL blacklists. So, essentially, large businesses and small businesses, medium businesses have intrusion protection systems, which sit in between the internet and their corporate internal network, and it keeps attackers on the outside from attacking the inside, and it also keeps machines on the inside that may have been compromised from sending information back out. There's two types. There's intrusion prevention, and there's intrusion detection. So you have IDS and IPS. Intrusion detection is just a monitor. So it just says, okay, you know, here is a problem. Somebody's trying to, you know, attack your network. Intrusion prevention, on the other hand, is actually kind of has some... It is proactive. It has some artificial intelligence involved where it says, okay, I see this traffic coming in. I know this is bad traffic, so I'm going to block this IP, and I'm going to blacklist this URL, et cetera. So they're talking about using this for home. So say, for instance, you buy this $179 iGuardian box, and you put it in between where your internet comes in, like a cable modem or whatever, and your home router. Then if you had a computer on the inside that somehow or another got a virus or malware and it was trying to send traffic out, then it would block that and alert you of that. And then also if someone was trying to hack your home network, which we talked a lot about in the last couple of weeks about those Internet of Things.
Right.
You know, and we've talked a lot about that. And if your refrigerator or your oven or whatever Internet of Things tries to hack it, crack it, I guess, is the right word. If they try to crack that device, then this device could alert you of that.
I don't know. If I hack someone's fridge, I want to display a friendly message that says, is your refrigerator running? Wait, am I running? Sorry,
you're out of bologna.
It's like I just bought some last week. I don't care. Buy more.
That's one of the saddest things in life, running out of bologna. I mean, that's right behind not having a tomato to put on your bologna sandwich. Those. I don't know that it gets much sadder than that. I mean, I guess it would be sad if your home network got hacked and you didn't have this intrusion French prevention device. But I'm not so sure it would be as sad as not having bologna and not having tomato to go on your bologna and cheese sandwich. Just a personal opinion.
I think I'm broke. So I just had this message in the fridge just like telling you all these mean messages.
And I come up with bologna sandwiches.
You have too much ice cream. You should stop eating ice cream. Oh, I'm sorry. IBM. Okay, so let's back up a little bit. IBM used to dominate the desktop hardware market, basically. This was, what would you say, late 90s, early, mid, late, early 90s? I don't know. Off of the 90s?
From the late 70s all the way up through...
You win.
Yeah, all the way up through probably the early 90s.
Okay, so IBM did that. And then they spun off their PC division and... I guess, did either Lenovo buy it, or they spin it off and it became Lenovo? I actually don't know the answer to that question.
I'm pretty sure Lenovo bought it because Lenovo's a Chinese company.
Okay, that makes more sense now.
Yeah.
All right, so I knew that IBM had spun off their PC division, and it was purchased by Lenovo. Well, now, if this happened in 2005, now Lenovo is poised to acquire IBM's line of x86-based servers and has garnered the approval of a regulatory body which could have scotched the deal. The article describes the server line at issue as low-end, but that is in the eye of the beholder, of course. From the article, the conclusion of the review by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFIUS?
I think it's CFIUS. I don't know.
CFIUS? Well, there's an I don't know. It's good news for both IBM and Lenovo, and for our customers and employees. Just give some of this. Basically, IBM's... low-end server line isn't doing so well, and they can get rid of it. And Lenovo, on the other hand, they can jump into this business by acquiring this and can hopefully turn it around and do good. Should we explain what x86 really?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you've got two different types of processing systems. You've got x86, which is a 32-bit processing system, and you got x64, which is a 64-bit processing system. And, you know, with 32-bit, you can only program up to, you know, 32 bits in a field. And with 64-bit architecture, you have 64 bits worth that you can put in a field. And so essentially what it does is it doubles the amount of computations that you can do on the processor. So most servers out there today are... X64 or 64-bit, I'm sorry, 64-bit servers, where their processors can handle those larger computational values.
Yep. And to the end consumer, 64-bit, almost all computers sold now are, if you don't specify anything special, I would say that I would venture to say they're 64-bit. Now, what 64-bit will provide you on the consumer end is you can upgrade your RAM to higher than 4 gigs. 32-bit processors can only accommodate up to 4 gigs of RAM, though officially you're not ever going to reach all 64 gigs, but that's more along the lines of theoretical anyway. So 64-bit processors for the end user allows you to get more than 4 gigs of RAM. So that's about all I have to say about that.
Well, there was a lot of concern over this. Whenever this news came out that IBM was going to push off their servers to a Chinese-based company.
Oh, cybersecurity, yeah.
Does it give me pause? Yes.
It would mean.
But there's a lot of stuff, a lot of all kinds of equipment that's in our networking realm that's made in China anyway. So, I guess the biggest thing is... I get concerned anytime that this type of stuff gets pushed out of the U.S. just because I like capitalism and I like the U.S. having this business inside. IBM, you know, is the modern day Roman Empire. I mean,
they had their time
and they have crumbled. I would go as far as to put that in the past tense and say that they have crumbled, past tense.
Mm-hmm.
And they're grasping now. They're grasping for air, gasping for air, and grasping for something to hold on to continue in the technology sector. I think they're just trying to find their focus, and mm-hmm. I don't think they've really found it yet. I mean, they stayed in the mainframe too long, and it was a great business for them, and then all of a sudden, people didn't need the mainframe anymore.
No.
People didn't need the mini frame anymore either. And everything went to servers, and then everything went to blades, and their technology in that sector just wasn't as good as everybody else's, and it fell apart.
Yep. They mentioned they're trying to go towards other growing areas, such as cloud computing and data analytics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
And that's what Watson was all about. If you remember when Watson played Jeopardy, data analytics was what Watson was all about. It had the ability to amass all these terabytes and terabytes of data and reference them in a very quickly indexable way to be able to, provide an answer to a sentence that was given, that was queried to it.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. Last article for our tech roundup, a IDC article here about cell phone sales. The worldwide smartphone market reached a new milestone in the second quarter of 2014 and moving past the 300 million unit mark for the first time in history. According to final data from the IDC, or the International Data Corporation, vendors shipped a total of 301.3 million smartphones worldwide in the second quarter of 2014.
Ooh.
301.3 million smartphones worldwide in the second quarter of 2014. That's a lot of smartphones. We're just talking about smartphones here. Up 25.3% from the 245.5 million units shipped in the second quarter of 2013. So 25% increase in the number of smartphones shipped between second quarter 2013 and second quarter 2014. And this information just released last week on the 14th. The dominant smartphone OS's operating systems, Android and iOS, saw their combined market share. Combined market share swell to 96.4% for the quarter, leaving little space for competitors. Android was the primary driver, with its vendor partners shipping a total of 255.3 million Android-based smartphones in second quarter 2014, up 33% year-over-year. Meanwhile, iOS saw its market share decline despite posting a 12.7% year-over-year shipment growth, and while Android and iOS realized gains from a year ago, the rest of the market share recorded losses.
Hmm.
Just some numbers here. iOS, Android had 33.3% growth year over year, 12.7% growth for iOS. And then between 2013 second quarter, 2014 second quarter, Windows Phone lost 9.4%. Their sales in 2013 were 8.2, or their shipments in 2013 second quarter were 8.2 million units. That went down to 7.4 million units. And then with BlackBerry, sorry for anybody who likes BlackBerry, they were down 78%. 6.7 million units shipped in 2013 second quarter.
Poor Rev.
1.5 million units shipped second quarter of 14. So, I mean, that's a huge difference.
I bet the vast majority of those are businesses still running on their dedicated email server.
Their RIM servers.
Their RIM servers, yeah. I bet.
And I'd say a lot of people moved off of, or attempting to move off of those. And there were some others here that don't amount to anything, but it's just an amazing number. And second quarter last year, 2013, there were 240.5 million shipments of smartphones in the world. And that went up by 61 million this year. There were 61 million more, 25% more. You know, that's just unreal.
That's crazy.
I mean, the numbers are just staggering. You know, 25% growth between second quarter 13 and second quarter 14 for worldwide shipments of smartphones. I mean, how often do you walk down the street now or go to somebody, you know, see somebody in the store, in the Walmart or the mall, and they don't have a smartphone?
It's rare.
It's real rare. Very and, rare. I mean, the numbers show that.
I've heard people talking and saying, well, hopefully next, when my contract's up, I can get a smartphone. You're still using feature phone, but I think I've heard one conversation like that in the past year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, most people, you know, and obviously there's got to be a level off to it somewhere, but I don't think we're close to it because, you know, Apple tried to enter the Chinese market this past year with the iPhone C, 5C, which really didn't work out for them. It was a bust. They didn't get the price right. They didn't get the product right. And I can't blame the Chinese people for it because, I mean, it was almost like, okay, here is a, you know, here's a phone that's not quite as good as the 5S, and we're going to give it to you for a little cheaper price.
Let me interject here on what Apple typically does. Typically, Apple releases premium devices. You buy an Apple product, you have the device. You have the top of the line of whatever line they have. In terms of their phones, there is only one iPhone. There's always only been one iPhone, the iPhone 3. Then they release a new one, stop production, the old one. Then they release a new one. Well, with the iPhone 5, they released two different ones. Mm-hmm. That's very odd for Apple to really, you know, they have the 5S. That's the premium. And then you have the not-so-premium, the 5C. So it's very odd for, I don't think Steve Jobs would have been, you know, behind that.
No, I mean, they were trying to get into a market, and all their numbers showed that was going to get them in the market, and everybody was saying, well, I'm not so sure this is going to get you in the market by itself, just, you know, creating this new type of phone, and it didn't. You know, and we could see that their numbers year over year have, you know, pretty much flattened off. Mm-hmm. I mean, They had 13% of, well, actually, they've dropped a little bit, but they had 13% of the market share last year, and they had only 11% of the market share this year at second quarter. So, I mean, you know, Android is really starting to blow up, and where Android's blowing up is in third, you know, in second and third world countries. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the States and in first world countries, obviously, that have Android as well. But it's really blowing up in other countries other than the U.S. And Apple just hasn't quite found that niche market yet in those other places.
Hmm. I wonder if that's because in those niche places, because it's cheaper or because it's more customizable.
I think it has a lot to do with price. I think that they just can't get their devices. I mean, here in the States, an iPhone is a status symbol.
Yeah,
but
true.
It's not so much the case in other countries. So, you know, in a place where your device isn't a status symbol, then you actually have to market your device by price.
It's something else.
I mean, in the States, they could pretty much charge whatever they want to for it, and people are going to buy it because, oh, I have an iPhone.
Yep.
But that's not the case in other places, and you're going to have to you're going to have to change your marketing plan for that. So that does it for our tech roundup, and now it's time to move into our app of the week. This week's app of the week is the Tile app, T-I-L-E app. You can find that at thetileapp.com. And, Kurt, have you seen the Tile app yet?
Nope.
Okay. The Tile is a little a little device that you can stick on pretty much anything you want to stick it on. And it's the world, they call it the world's largest lost and found.
I think I need this.
It's pretty cool. So it's an RFID tag, and there was an editor rating of it that I found, and they said, well, actually, let me read what Tile has to say about their stuff first here.
The website just made me sick. This big giant scroll is happening.
So it's small and sleek. Tiles go everywhere you do. Just attach, stick, or drop your tile into any item that you might lose, like a laptop, wallet, keys, guitars, bikes, you name it. Then get on with the fun. This is directly from their website. The Tile app on your phone makes it easy and fun to find your tiles anywhere, anytime. So what happens is it's kind of like a social network almost of helping you find your device. Other people who have the Tile app can help you find your device if you allow them to do so. And from an article that I read, it said that the pros were helps you quickly find misplaced items. The Tile is small, lightweight, and well-designed. Cons are it has a non-removable battery, so you need to buy a new one every year, and they don't have any Android support yet.
Everybody not using iPhone.
Which is kind of strange seeing that, you know, Android posted 80-something percent of market share.
I think developers are going to have to figure out that you have to go where the people are.
Yeah. So the bottom line from this editor, they said, with a polished app and solid performance, Tile is a useful lost and found gadget that helps you keep tabs on your stuff, but it only works with iOS. So it's pretty cool. You can watch some videos of it out there at thetileapp.com. I actually saw this when they started out. This was a type of Kickstarter. I don't know if it was on Kickstarter or not, but it was a Kickstarter type thing. And I caught up with this whenever they first started it, and it's pretty neat. It's an RFID tag that has a range of about 50 to 150 feet, depending upon, you know, what type of building you're in. The bad thing is, like they said, it does have its own internal battery, so after about a year, you have to chuck it and buy another one. So it comes with a built-in speaker, so you can hear it when you're in close range. It lasts about a year, about how long the battery will work. These are not quite out yet in the market, but you can pre-order them, and they're $20 a pop.
Well, for Windows phone and any Nokia users, you've got an alternative called the Nokia Treasure Tag. I'll throw that out there. This has a removable battery. Unfortunately, it costs $30. Maximum standby time 180 days. It has a battery level indicator. I just thought that was interesting. I was like, I wonder if there's an alternative.
How big is it?
Let's see here, 30 millimeters by 30 millimeters.
Yeah, I was trying to see how big the tile was.
And thickness is 10 millimeters. So this is one you'd, like, clip to something. His doesn't stick.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the tile will stick. It also has a little hole in it where you can put it, like, on a keychain or something like that. Keychain.
Gotcha.
But it's something interesting for our listeners to go out and take a look at. You know, it's nice that people are coming out with this kind of thing where you could track things. But it's thetileapp.com. And you can go out and take a look at that. And that is our app of the week. And now we're going to move into our deep dive. First article in this week's deep dive comes from Network World and also from Computer World. About 4.5 million people in 28 states face the risk of identity theft due to massive data breach at Community Health Systems, or CHS, a Franklin, Tennessee-based health network. It's close to us here, not too far away from us. CHS, which operates over 200 hospitals, disclosed a regulatory filing Monday that hackers, apparently based out of China, access systems containing data sometime in April and June. Hackers successfully bypassed the company's security controls and siphoned out names, social security numbers, addresses, birth dates, and phone numbers of people who received or were referred for services by CHS-affiliated doctors over the past 5 years. Security firm Mandiant, which is investigating the breach, believes that a known Advanced Persistent Threat, or APT group, based in China, is responsible for the breach. CHS said in its filing. And then there was another article from Computer World that said that there was a grocery store also that was hit by a security breach. The name of that grocery store was it's the Super Value Incorporated Group. They run Albertsons, Cub Foods, Jewel Osco, Shop and Save, Star Market, and Shaw's. I think these are mostly out Midwest and West. They had a between July 22nd and July 17th, they had a data breach. Credit and debit card data may have been obtained from customers of some of these stores. In a statement, they said that the intrusion resulted in the theft of account numbers, cardholder names, expiration dates, and other data from payment cards used at some of the company's stores during that time. So, you know, once again, this week, almost like we talk about every week, some massive data breaches, you know, two in a week for this past week, multiple others in the last few weeks. You know, Kurt, what do we watch for when we're, you know, when we're using our personal data out and about? You know, what do we got to be careful of?
Anything that looks suspicious. I mean, I hate to sound like that and so vague, but yeah, I mean, don't give out your information. And if you absolutely have to give it out to only people you trust. And even then, you know, change passwords frequently. I mean, we could go over the same thing, broken record things all the time, but seriously, it's true. You know, I've been debating whether or not to say this, but passwords should be... I shouldn't do this. Passwords should be like your underwear. Change them frequently. Don't share them with anyone else. And keep them mysterious. Don't...
Exactly.
And there was one more point. I can't remember what it was. I already said don't share and don't give them out to other people. So, I mean, honestly, change your passwords frequently. That's one big thing I can think of here. Just look for things that look, you know, warning signs. I get spam email frequently from some looks like it's out of China. I mean, I think it's legitimate. I don't require any services that they're asking for, something about fasteners or something like that. I mean, but... You know, it just hit me. You know, this could be a hacker that's doing some kind of a phishing attempt.
Exactly.
I never thought about that till this exact moment. I just thought, oh, that's spam. Okay, go away. That is so, I mean, what do you do?
Well, you know, and in these situations, I don't know that there's anything that the people that shopped at Super Value stores or
end users
from this, from Community Health Systems in Franklin, Tennessee could have done. I mean, this is upon the responsibility of those companies to protect their data. You know, it just goes to remind us that, you know, whenever someone does contact you and says, okay, and notice I didn't say if, I said when. Ooh, when sure. Someone contacts you and says, okay, we have lost your personal information to a, you know, outside entity. Then you need to be prepared to know what to do with those changes. And, you know, you need to know your rights, your right for that company to provide you with credit checks and to provide you with, information on what's going on in the situation. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not a thing of if, it's a thing of when it happens to you and to know what you need to do. Obviously, these people need to, you know, cancel their credit cards. They need to they need to, you know, look at their bank statements. They need to probably maybe even change their bank account numbers. They need to make sure that they're getting a credit check done by that company, because that company should provide them with a credit check. There's a number that goes along with this, Kurt. For every person.
Oh, yeah.
Every person that is affected by a breach, $300. That's the number.
So
it's $300 per person.
Usually, let's say, for instance, if it were Walmart, how many people shop at Walmart?
Oh, man, yeah, that's unbelievable.
Millions.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a small hospital system here, and this is 4.5 million people.
4.5 million. Now times that by 300, and that is... you know, the number that they're going to have to pay for.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a health system that goes over 28 states, but it, you know, 4.5 million people for this health system. I mean, $300 a person for 4.5 million people. I mean, and what we're talking about, the $300 a person is, that's money that's going to, you know, give them credit checks. That's going to make sure that, you know, the proper information is to the authorities and all that kind of thing. So, you know, $300 per person, that's a lot of money. You know, that's why these companies need experts. That's why these companies need people who are experts in the security field, who are, you know, CISSPs,
yeah,
who know what they're doing and who have the ability to look for this type of attacks coming and prevent them, or at least stop them from being so big. And, you know, this thing of having a CISSP certification, which is the gold standard for security professionals, and to be well-versed in this, this is going to come down from the feds, Kurt.
Yeah, everyone's going to need it.
And everybody's going to need it. And so, you know, it's kind of sad to think that, you know, you have to be so worried about this kind of stuff, but you do.
It's what we're coming to.
It is what we're coming to. So, you know, I guess what we pull from that article is, you know, when the time comes that, you know, your data is breached, when your personal information is breached by a company, then, you know, you need to be prepared to say, hey, you know, okay, where's my credit check? Where's the things that you're supposed to give me? Because this is what needs to be done to save your rear end.
Mm-hmm.
Last deep dive article for the day comes from Droid Life. Verizon making some plan changes. They quietly introduced a brand new single line plan that certainly isn't the worst deal you'll find in the wireless industry. At $60, $60, the new plan offers unlimited talk and text along with 2 gigs of data per month. You can lower that rate further by buying a new phone through Verizon Edge device payment plan and shave off another $10. And Verizon Edge is just one of their plans that allows you to pay for your device that you buy, like an iPhone or whatever. You pay for that monthly, and then I think it's after 60 days or so many bill payments, you can trade your phone in again.
I think AT&T is called the Next Plan.
Plan with AT&T, yeah, same type thing. And if you get Verizon Edge, it shaves another $10 off, bringing your monthly service down to $50 a month plus your Edge payment for your device. Verizon originally introduced new single line plans, which is no shared data. It's just, you know, if, you know, I wanted to go out and buy a phone for myself back in March at prices that weren't exactly competitive, which was $60 for 1 gig, $75 for 2 gigs. But at $60 for 2 gigs, this new plan is $5 lower than AT&T's competing single line plan. And the new plan also matches up to the secret save plan from Verizon that Verizon wasn't publicly promoting a few months back. So, you know, interesting move here by Verizon to try to one-up AT&T. And, Kurt, I love this kind of thing because this is increasing.
Capitalism.
It's capitalism. It's increasing competition, and I like it.
The consumer wins in this case.
Exactly, and I love when that happens.
Oh, yeah. I hear a lot of competing products, you know, obviously in the gaming scene, I see the PS4 versus the Xbox One. And the Wii U, you know, most people just don't even count, you know, the Wii U. But in this case of Verizon AT&T, you know, what differences are there between the two networks? You know they're not going to, people are basically not arguing over the networks anymore. Now it's over the prices and what they're offering. So
go check it out, Verizon.com. You can go check out those new single line plans. And now it's time for Tech and Numbers, that part of our show. And today, Tech and Numbers, technology was up by 0.6% today, 0.6%, almost 0.7%, which was a good day for technology. Perfect. A few of our folks who were doing gainers today was GSI Technology. They were up about a half of a point, 9% for them. Perfect World Company, which is a developer in China, they were down almost 3 points or 12%. So kind of a rough day for them. Ouch. And some of our big folks, Apple, they were up almost a point and a half, and Microsoft was up a half a point today. And that brings all down for tech in numbers.
I guess we have enough time for this. This is my favorite part. This is my favorite part. The weird and wacky tech. I just got rid of the song.
You turned off your music.
I did
that
it too
love.
Quickly. This is called the No Phone. I'm just going to read this article I saw. Every so often, a device is created that is so singularly revolutionary in its execution that it's difficult to imagine the world before it. The iPhone, the PC, the Atari 2600 are all examples of these kinds of revolutionary devices. Now, you can add another gadget to the list. The No Phone, and that's with no space in between there. This handset is shatterproof, waterproof, and doesn't require charging to function. It's also completely resistant to NSA surveillance and hacking, to the best of our knowledge anyway. Unfortunately, it's not yet equipped with Wi-Fi, nor Bluetooth, nor a screen, or cellular connection for that matter. Still, as its creators note, the No Phone can help you to never again experience the unsettling feeling of flesh on flesh when closing your hand. No pricing or availability information has yet been released, but we're, this group is reaching out for details. In the meantime, feast your eyes on the jaw-dropping demo video. I see we'll probably have to add this one. It's about 4 seconds long.
Yeah, I saw it. It's 3 seconds to be exact.
3 seconds long.
It's essentially a piece of plastic that looks like an iPhone, and it's for people like me who have a hard time putting down their phone, or at least that's what my wife tells me. She tells me I have a hard time putting down my devices.
From the website, with a thin, light, and completely wireless design, the No Phone acts as a surrogate to any smart mobile device, enabling you to always have a rectangle of smooth, cold plastic to clutch without foregoing any potential engagement with your direct environment. Never again experience the unsettling feeling of flesh on flesh when closing your hand. The No Phone simulates the exact weight and dimensions of your most beloved gadget, iPhone, in order to alleviate any feelings of inadequacy generated by the absence of a real smartphone. How does it work? Pick it up. Hold it. That's honestly what it says.
So if you have to charge your iPhone and you can't hold on to your iPhone all day, you can get you a No Phone and hold on to that and walk around with it while your iPhone's charging, right?
Testimonials. I used to sleep with my phone in my hand, but my night terrors would cause me to hurl it across the room in an unconscious panic. With a No Phone, I can still enjoy the comfort of holding a phone in my sleep without waking up to a shattered screen. Thanks, No Phone.
Wow.
With the No Phone, my eye contact skills have improved 73%. Because of the No Phone, I haven't drunk texted my ex-boyfriend in 1 whole week. And the last testimonial says, not a real phone. battery free, no upgrades necessary, shatterproof, waterproof. I mean, it's even got like a little place where the camera I love this thing. I almost want to buy this.
So just so our listeners know, this is weird and funny, weird and wacky tech, so this is just a joke. So yeah. nophone.eu, I think, is where you can see that video at, and somebody come up with a nice joke, probably to make fun of somebody who uses their phone too much.
Oh, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, now kids nowadays, what, they want cell phones, right? They're going to, you know, they get old enough to, I guess, have a phone. I don't know what the right age is, but you buy them this, or even better, put it in a case, and
oh, that'd be great. That'd be a nice trick on somebody.
Oh, this is great. The No Phone.
Well, that wraps it up for today for Tech Talk today. We thank you for listening to today's show. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/WCCRTechTalk and on Twitter at WCCRTechTalk as well. You can also find our podcast of today's show by searching Tech Talk Today on iTunes or just taking a look at it on Facebook. And once again, I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Stay with us on 94.5 LPFN, the WCCR, for our Super Tuesday lineup for summer 2014. For the next 2 hours, you'll hear the Figure Four Fallout with Russell Ridner, Bo Kidd, Casey Malone, Dustin Hardin, and Justin Durbin. Thank you so very much, and have a great week.